Welcome to Crash Concepts, where the economy, energy, and the environment are explored. Up next, fresh ideas and insights into the factors that are driving the world and shaping your future. Presenting information you can't afford to live without, here's Chris Martinson.
Welcome to this Peak Prosperity Podcast. I am your host, Chris Martinson, and it is December 21st, 2016, so happy solstice, everybody. It is perhaps fitting that we're recording this podcast on the shortest day of the year, because things can only get brighter from here, at least physically brighter. Perhaps not financially or geopolitically, but that remains to be seen. Now, in order to assess where we're headed, what could be better than a gigantic romp through where we've just been? Continuing with our annual tradition, we've got the best year-end review in the business, thanks to today's guest, Dave Collum. For those of you unfamiliar with Dave, he's professor of chemistry and chemical biology at Cornell University, where I got my MBA. And in addition to his academic interests, David authors an annual macroeconomic assessment titled The Year in Review. Great, great title. And it's hands down, listen, it's the best synopsis of anything that mattered during the previous 12 months. I'm super excited for today's podcast. Dave's latest year in review can once again be found in full and in all its glory on peakprosperity.com. I'm excited to have him with us now live in order to expand on his excellent insights. Dave, thank you for joining us again this year.
Hey, I'm glad to be here. I actually was just editing the last of the galleys for this thing for Adam. So it's kind of fresh on my mind. At this time of year, my mind is buzzing with this annual review thing. So I almost can't speak without citing it now.
Well, listen, it's such a huge work. And I have to thank you on behalf of everybody for taking the time to put pen to paper or finger to keyboard, as the case may be, and delivering this yearly review. This one, I think, is there was so much material. It's probably your longest ever.
Yeah, actually, it presented a problem for me because when I started in January, I knew that I knew the election would overwhelm the year. Now, that was patently obvious. I'd written these things through previous elections, and I never had that sense, but this year was pretty clear. And then I also knew that there was a dozen players, most of them Republican, but a dozen players who by November 9th would be irrelevant. They'd be footnotes. And so I somehow had to keep track of all these different players and what was happening, and then knowing that they would be relegated to footnotes by the end, and that there would be one probably highly polarizing figure left standing. And as I refer to it, the rest would be chalk outlines around that person. And as we now know, it is Donald Trump.
And that's so amazing. So you're writing this year about themes. And this year's theme that obviously deserves a lot of attention where you started is the presidential election. So I want to start there. But listen, with failures and mendacity everywhere, let's begin with the easy prey. Just how badly did mainstream media press screw this one up?
It depends on what their goals were. Yeah, they screwed it up in unimaginable ways. At the beginning of my year in reviews, I always come out and support the notion of conspiracy theories. And I denounce those who use conspiracy as a pejorative because really men and women of wealth and power conspire. And to anyone who doesn't think that's true, it's just an idiot. And this year with the election, the WikiLeaks, the curtain got pulled back. And so anyone who could somehow get through 2016 believing that conspiracies don't exist is just a complete buffoon, right? And so I open up with that. The press's role in the election this year was just staggering to me. And it was obvious because as Trump got more and more powerful, that the press became more and more blatant in their attempts to engineer the outcome of the election. And then by the end, we also, thanks to WikiLeaks, we also knew that we knew in advance of that, but we got confirmation that the press was completely in cahoots with the DNC. So.
Well, absolutely. They got a lot wrong, obviously, and I want to get to how they missed the most obvious thing, which is what the appeal of Trump might have been. But first, You know, I was just driving around today. I had NPR on for a second. There's a little fresh air going. I'm not listening to it because I'm drawn to it. I had to turn it off because they had the chief political correspondent from Politico on there talking all about just how bad Putin has it out for the Clintons and how Mrs. Clinton is pretty sure, Hillary is sure that Putin did something. And they're just running with this whole, the Russians did something in our election meme with zero evidence, but this is helping the people on some people on the left feel better because they don't have to look in the mirror and say, what went wrong? How did the DNC not only shoot itself in one foot, but probably both feet? Instead of soul searching, they're going for the who can we blame. And I find this continued demonization of Putin, which was a big theme for 2016, I find this to be a really dangerous game. And I'm not really sure who's driving that ship. But it's just, I think the people who are willingly running with that ball at this point in time is a means of preventing a good hard look at what went wrong for their party. I find that particularly troubling at this point because it's not dying down. It's whatever mistakes were made are being continued. It's sort of a doubling down on the mistakes as I see it.
You know, for 3 years now, I've written by Western standards fairly favorably about Putin. Now, I'm a Reagan Republican, so this is not something I came to easily, but I think Pat Buchanan said it well. He says Putin's a Russian nationalist, he's a hard ass, right? I mean, he's a tough guy. He's someone not to be messed with. But I think that he possibly is who Russia needs running that place. I don't know, but the demonization of Putin to me is very scary, as you said. And the irony for me is that throughout the election they said, you know, Trump was going to. Meanwhile, the Democrats and Hillary were demonizing Putin in a way that that to me was much riskier. To me, I think Trump has very few militaristic intentions in him, which was ultimately what made me think pretty hard about voting for him as opposed to, say, a third party. And I think picking on Putin the way we did was as you said, pushes us a little towards the brink. And if they keep doing it, they could get us there. Fortunately, I think Trump actually has no interest in pushing him around. Maybe in the end, we'll find out that that's a problem. But right now, I'd like to stop bombing the Middle East. I'd like to stop sticking a stick in Putin's eye. And Hillary scared the hell out of me because she looked like she'd happily do both.
Well, she said right in the second presidential debate, which was a full deal killer for me with her, that she would support a no-fly zone over Syria, which, if you understand things, the U.S. has no U.N. mandate to impose such a thing, and Russia is flying planes around the airspace of Syria legally, and so that she was openly saying, yeah, oh yeah, I'm all for an act of war with Russia, which I am thoroughly on record as saying, bad idea, but still that meme is running. Somebody somewhere is still saying, we have to get Putin in a box, and they're trying to put Trump in a box, which I know this is a little off the year in review, but it feels to me like, you know, 2016, that theme is continuing, and I'm not sure to what end, and nobody's been able to explain to me why we should hate Putin or Russia so much at this point. They feel like more natural allies to me at this stage of history, given where China is, than an enemy, but somebody's decided they're the worst thing since spam in a can.
Yeah, you know, when we pried open the Russian archives after the Berlin Wall came down, one of the things that supposedly came out of that was the fact that much to what we were told, the Russians were reactive, not proactive in terms of the West. And that is that their view is they were simply responding to our actions. Mm-hmm. And I think that's more true now than ever. And I watched a couple of interviews of Putin, obviously with a translator, and I listened to what he had to say, and I had this sense that he understood the risk and he understood the Middle East better than we do. Now maybe our, you know, guys who have top security clearance understand the Middle East, but the Americans don't. And I'm a little surprised at how many people just accept at face value that Putin is the enemy. He's been demonized, but I haven't seen anything that tells me that he is actually a serious threat. The stuff going on in the Ukraine and Crimea, we triggered that. That was U.S. You know, we were moving pawns around the chessboard in places that Putin had to defend.
Yeah, well, and to this day, that's still described as the annexation of Crimea, when Crimea voted well over 90% in a fair, free, open election to rejoin Russia, who, by the way, it didn't seem odd to me, and maybe this is my difficulty having context, but that the Russian-speaking people and Russian-cultured people in Crimea, who since 1954 had had their language and their customs banned and otherwise trodden on by the Ukrainians, that they didn't want to join and stay with the people in Kiev who were openly saying, let's kill all the Russian-speaking people. Somehow they decided when they voted that they wanted to vote to rejoin Russia, who was saying, like, oh, no, we'd like you to survive and live and thrive. It was such an easy choice. I don't know how you still call that an annexation, but everybody runs with that, from NPR to the National Review to the Brookings. Everybody agrees. That was a horrible annexation. It was a big crime. But again, it's lacking that mirror perspective, because last I checked, Russia hasn't attacked anybody without on trumped up evidence, for example.
Well, I'd like to know, everything is in terms of what I wrote, because things I really care about, I wrote about. But I make sort of facetiously the statement about the huge American casualties caused by Syria. And then I said, I'm working on where those are.
Yeah, exactly.
We have destroyed Syria, right? I mean, we've really, Aleppo, Martha Raddatz asked somebody, what happens if Aleppo falls? And you look at Aleppo and you go, there's no Aleppo left, it's fallen. And it's gone. It's a city that was, thousands of years old, and now it's just a pile of garbage. And we kind of did that. If I were hoping for Trump to do something as president, I could imagine him standing up there and saying, look, guys, you have oil over here. We want to buy it. And provided you keep selling it to us, we're good to go. And if you want to think about, U.S. national interest, you could add to it. And if you refuse to sell it to us, then we're going to come over and turn this place into a sheet of glass. But otherwise, we want to be your customers, right? And that notion first showed up when I read about some German oil expert who was chatting about how we were fighting the Arabs. And he said, I don't know why you guys keep bombing this place. We just buy the oil.
Well, a couple of different approaches, right? So the same thing. China's all over the world with its magic checkbook, something I've been noting for a while. So that's part of it. And let's start to connect the economics to what we've just been talking about. So certainly, I listen, the whole fake news thing, the Russia angle, the all this stuff, my opprobrium I'm going to heap on the mainstream media in the United States is this. They clearly were revealed to have not been doing their jobs. They were not impartial arbiters. They were not providing essential context. When confronted with that, their next strategy was to say, well, let's see if we can drag all our competitors down to our level, rather than saying, how do we up our game, right? How do we become relevant and provide stuff that people want, which would be news that's accurate in some way. So with all that aside, I'm still wondering how the mainstream media and many political operatives are missing the explanation for the Trump phenomenon, which I think I'm going to draw from your recent piece, part one of the Year in Review. And quote, this is what you wrote, quote, the wealth for middle-class households has dropped 30% since 2000. One in five kids lives in poverty. One in five. 46 million folks are on food stamps. 20% of the families have nobody employed, despite the 4.9% unemployment number. And almost 50% of all 25-year-olds are living with mom and dad, unable to translate that self-exploration major into a job. Half of all American workers make less than $30,000 a year, and 62% of Americans have less than $1,000 in savings. To me, that explains a lot, and still that's not being talked about.
Yeah. The problem with those numbers is they're not numbers that you can... They present a dilemma. You defined two things. You said there's a predicament and a problem.
Right.
What did you say?
Now,
you
problems have solutions, but predicaments
don't.
Just have outcomes. You have to manage the outcomes.
That's a predicament. I remember I was struck by that when I listened to, I don't remember whose podcast it was, but that's a predicament when you are 55 years old and you have $17,000 in savings. You're in a predicament. The people listening to this who are sitting there going, wait a minute, I'm 55 years old and I have 17,000 savers. Savings. You have my condolences. I don't know how you're going to do it.
Right.
And we're not going to be able to grow our way out of this, right? This reminds me of a business that's basically run out of cash, right? It doesn't have a mechanism to function now. And so that's where the savers are. And then you get these numbnut central bankers who insist that, well, our goal is to drop rates to get people to consume. And it's clear that the consumers now, I think they really now get it. I mentioned that Larry Summers thinks that they've got too much debt. Larry Summers has totally ignored the fact that they also are looking at their retirement accounts and saying, I don't have anything.
Mm-hmm.
And therefore, how can that consumer go and buy something? You can drop rates to whatever number you want, and they're saying, I can't spend anymore. So that's right. A predicament.
And it provides a lot of the fuel for the populist uprisings, which we're seeing all over the globe at this point in time. And my macro explanation for this, Dave, is that global growth is over. What we used to have, what we fashioned all of our policies and all of our monetary policies, fiscal policies, expectations, dreams, hopes, all of that was fashioned when we had 6.7% nominal GDP for 3.5% to 4% real GDP. Those days are gone. And they've been gone for arguably for a decade, and that should be enough time. But people haven't gotten their heads around that yet. And so we have the predicament of dropping rates, goosing the markets, printing like crazy, and still that magic growth genie won't reappear no matter how hard we rub. And so that, I think, is creating some of that discomfort that's showing up politically as people are going, hey, wait a minute, you guys. The story seems to be broken. You just keep turning the crank on this machine, and all that seems to happen is you guys get richer and my life gets harder. I'm not sure I'm down with that story anymore.
Yeah, in some sense, all of what you just said, at some level, reduces down to a demographic model too. And so we have this situation where the boomers are looking to retire, and there's too many of them and not enough highly productive people younger than them. And so there was this boom. While we had this huge bolus of boomers all pulling on the oars, all pulling the economy forward, and not demanding freebies, right? What's a freebie? I don't mean to say they haven't worked for it, but they're not now drawing debt. At the time, they weren't drawing off the system. They were producing and they were consuming, but so the economy was rolling forward. Now those boomers, they haven't started yet, really. That's the misunderstanding. But they're going to start to demand that they get goods and services without pulling on the oar.
So Dave, you know, another part of this dynamic then for me is that because, you know, these interest rates got driven down, and you say because the Fed wanted to spur consumption, what's really happened, though, is that they've prevented interest payments, about $1 trillion in interest payments have no longer flowed from banks, in essence, to savers. And it's a savings account. So these poor young people out there who have the record amounts of student debt, who are coming into what's inarguably not an okay job market, with fairly depressed wages and all of that. But also, these young people are the ones who not only do household formation, but business formation. And many times the seed capital for that business formation is parents and grandparents who, ta-da, are missing about $1 trillion in interest payments. And so that's $1 trillion missing from business formation. So, you know, I'm wondering, you know, all these things are data numbers that are in your report. But if you can add to that, I mean, you're a professor, so you're interacting with these young people today, qualitatively, quantitatively. How are they perceiving what seems to be a situation where the deck is pretty well stacked against them?
So, again, I have the advantage of working with students who, because they're at Cornell, they certainly have a better chance than most, right?
Mm-hmm.
No matter, you know, independent of what they study. On average, they have a better chance than most. What we see, I think this is generally true when an economy turns south, when things start getting dicey, and people know it even if the Feds, and the Fed in the most general sense, Feds, the authority figures, tell us everything's rosy, everyone knows it's not. And what you see on a college campus when that's occurring, and I actually went to college during one of those times, it was in the middle of the 70s, so we had double-digit inflation garbage going on, is that the kids start choosing much more practical things to study. So they actually make the appropriate decision. And that is, you find far less people. You know, Henry Blodgett went to Wall Street on an English major. None of our kids are counting on that now, right? Mm-hmm. They're you see a flood towards practical issues. There's a bit of a crisis going on some of the campuses. The humanists, I think, are feeling a kind of an existential risk because I think you have a lot of kids heading off to college and their parents are saying, no, you're not going to major that subject. I'm not spending $200,000 for you to major, and I don't dare name one because I've got colleagues who are in it.
Mm-hmm.
But you know, go ahead and take a few courses in it, but you're trying to get a self-extinguishing loan here, right? You're trying to get a career that'll pay off all this debt. Don't major in something for which there will be no job. And the parents are pushing it, the kids are realizing it. You tend to see an increase in pre-medical students, for example, because that's a pretty dependable career. Law applications go way up because kids who majored in the wrong subjects do a do-over through law school, because anyone can get to law school, right? From any subject, I should say, not anyone can get there. And so you say, well, I now have a major in something that doesn't give me a job. I'll go to law school, then I'll have a job. And, you know, 10% of graduating law degrees do law and the rest do something else. And heaven only knows what. So you see a pragmatism reappear.
Okay.
Despite the social pressures that appear to be totally unpragmatic on campuses. So.
Well, that sounds perfectly normal and rational then. So there's some pressures out there and people respond appropriately. So let's turn to an organization that lacks that particular skill set, the Federal Reserve and other central banks. And I guess I want to back into the discussion of these central banks because, regarding equities being historically and wildly overvalued, you've got a great piece in the Year in Review, part one, about that. And you noted in there that a 76% overvaluation is regressed to the mean by a 43% correction, which will be as pleasant as baptizing a cat. I love that line. So that's probably where we're gonna get to. But my preferred version of where these markets are, had another line, which is captures what I believe to be true. And you said it is suggested that central banks and programmed investing have pushed a wall of money at the markets. Right. So Mark Spitznagel from Universa Investments, you have another quote that I think ties us all together. And he says, markets don't have a purpose anymore. They just reflect whatever central planners want them to. Why wouldn't it lead to the biggest collapse? My strategy doesn't require that I'm right about the likelihood of that scenario. Logic dictates to me that it's inevitable. So pull all that together, and we've got these programmed investing computers that are easily shoved around. If you have a willing non-economic participant like a central bank that's willing to lose a few tens of billions by just shoving them into markets, maybe the Central Bank of Switzerland, right, to get non-conspiratorial around it. Here's one, pushing with a balance sheet over 100% of its GDP, a good chunk of it in equities. Bank of Japan doing the same thing. So that sense of markets really being just now a reflection of what the central planners, aka the central banks, want, really feels to me badly out of step with reality. But there's a lot of people out there who've sort of taken the bait and said, this is the new normal. This is just how it's going to be. We can trust them. What's wrong with that view?
How about a simple answer? It's stupid.
Put that on a t-shirt. That would sell.
I had the luxury of having dinner with Mark Spitznagel about a year and a half ago. And we talked about the 09 bottom, mm-hmm. right? You and I think, have talked about this before, where the markets were collapsing. And to the world, it felt like it was hell's gates opening up. But the fact of the matter is, if you look at traditional valuation models, as the Dow is banging around 6,700, by historical measures, that was fair value.
Mm-hmm.
It was fair value using, you know, equity market to GDP ratios and also the equity market price to book value, things like that. Now, I'm a big believer in thermodynamics, which I bet you are too, being a scientist.
Yep.
And I believe that eventually you find that sort of thermodynamic minimum. And so another way of putting that is markets are notoriously mean regressing. So they will get way overvalued. They will stay way overvalued, but eventually they will regress back to and through the mean. And you mathematically have to spend equal time on both sides. So anyone who thinks we're never going to get through it and go to the other side is dreaming. And unless you think that we are not going to regress to the mean ever again, and it's an infinitely sustained prosperity, which is close to the 1929 quote of Irving Fisher, then at some point in our future is a what I call a mean regression. and
emphasis on mean.
There's a quote that I paraphrase Hussman. I don't know. Someone said it so clearly, and it captured the essence of everything you just said. And that is, if you pay above the historical norm prices for assets, you will get below the historical norm returns. I cannot say it simpler than that. And so the question then becomes, are we above the historical norm? People can debate that, but according to every valuation, including that composite Doug Short model that I used this year, we are looking at about a 50%. We're looking at the market cutting in half to get to the mean.
Right.
And I don't need to know when that's going to happen. This gets back to I read your book, Prosper. You're not planning for a specific point in time. You are planning for something that feels like it's going to happen, and you just got to be ready for when it does. And so to the extent that markets are mean regressing, I don't need to know when. I just need to know that if you buy way above normal prices, you're going to get way below normal returns. I'll sit on cash, thank you very much. And I am. Mm-hmm. And actually in 2009, I started buying equities at fair value. So I started buying very daintily in 2009, and I bought some tobacco stocks. I liquidated a prudent bear fund that I had. And I did this for about a month, and then it bounced off like a golf ball off a cart path. And when I was talking to Spitznagel, he said, that's exactly right. We spent weeks at fair value.
Weeks.
And you know, we're supposed to go through fair value. We're supposed to spend a handful of years below fair value in a real correction. And we didn't, and that's the Fed. So I'm saying, okay, it's coming. They were able to put a cork in it, but the pressure's building again. So I'm sitting in cash, and I've got it. My diversification, by the way, is not assets. I mean, I'm very undiversified in assets. I'm diversified in institutions. I have a lot of different accounts.
Mm-hmm.
And they're spread around of different types, you know, Charles Schwab, Vanguard, local bank, Citigroup, you know, I'm all over the place. I've got about 10 different accounts.
Yep, I do too. And I do that because I don't trust any one institution. And you do it because?
They'll collapse.
Somebody will.
That's right. We haven't even talked about balance, but I don't talk too much about the balance this year because they were a big topic last year, and I don't want to be a broken record, but you know, to the your readers know this, but I'll say it again. Balance, or this notion that instead of making the sovereign state bail out the banking system, we'll let the creditors bail them out. And what the average joker doesn't know is that you, as a depositor, are a creditor. And you are going to give up your wealth just like the Cypriots did when their banks got emptied on a bail-in. And so I don't know if I trust the 250,000 cap or not, that they say above that you could lose your money. But since 2009, they put a lot of legislation into position that makes bail-in. See, when 2009 hit, there were legal loopholes. There were legal weaknesses, I think, to actually solve the problem. I think they put in a lot of legislation to make the bail-ins doable. And that means, therefore, that that when the time comes, it's going to be very easy to say, oh, by the way, you just lost half your bank account because, well, this is a crisis and you lose and we all have to pay our fair share. And I have no intention of paying my fair share. I'm attempting to avoid that part.
Well, yeah, the bail-ins could strike at any time, and certainly something I talk about a lot. And here's how I think all this a lot of this ties together for me. You know, my macro analysis says that we are at the terminal stages of a grand debt supercycle, and you know, there's not a lot of choices at the end of one of those. I'm a big von Mises fan for this one quote, which says you either voluntarily abandon that credit cycle or you risk facing the catastrophe of the currency system involved. This explains to me why I think the central banks are so averse to allowing any sort of corrections to happen. It's why in 2009 we spent weeks at fair value because they freaked out and either hubris jumped in and they considered themselves to be masters of the universe. We can fix this. And that's our job, you know, Superman capes and everything. Or they're deeply afraid of what happens if that super cycle of debt really does draw to a close. They couldn't face that. So here we are. And it feels increasingly desperate to me, knowing that we're now, you had a great quote in there from Grant Williams, one of my favorite commentators and analysts, saying that we've had a central bank intervention on average every 3 days since the crisis started.
I have another quote I like even better from Grant. Grant is an adorable person, right? Grant is, I actually one time drove 5 hours to New York City just to spend the afternoon with Grant, right? Because I knew he was in New York City. And so he and a guy named Simon Mikhailovic and I, we just sat around for 4 or 5 hours and chatted because it was worth that drive for me. Mm. So in any event, Grant has another quote. He says, there's a difference between hadn't and hasn't.
And didn't.
That's really important because we keep hearing, well, nothing happened. And it hadn't happened. And he says, no, it hasn't happened. And that's a profoundly important linguistic distinction. It hasn't happened yet, but that's not to say it's not gonna.
Right. So, right. Well, in this debt super cycle, I mean, you know, either you keep it going or you don't. Those are basically the choices at this point. But, you know, realistically, where were we going to double and double and continue to double our debts down? You know, you noted that the average rate of debt accumulation in the U.S. government's around 8% a year, something like that, which means it's doubling rule of 72, what, every 9 or 10 years under that rate? 9 years, I guess?
Right on the money, 9, right.
Yeah, so that's astonishing. What are we going to do, just keep doubling our debt every 9 years? I mean, eventually you would think thoughtful people would go, listen, do your emergency stuff for 6 months, maybe a year, but that should probably be the extent of it, right? Here we are on our 8th year of emergency stuff, right? No end in sight. And obviously we're trapped at this point in time. What's your sense of having collected all these dots that other thoughtful, maybe large money people are starting to really understand that there's an unworkable plan here, that this is just not, there's no exit to this box canyon we're in?
Yeah, there is necessarily an exit. There's always an exit. You know, the system will dust itself off and move forward, but the exit, sometimes you don't want to be involved, right? The corrective measures can really stink. And so I'm not as ready as you. Let me just make that clear. I was trying to remember back when we first chatted, you were only partway through your crash course. And I was thinking about this today, knowing we were going to be chatting, and I was thinking about the fact that your crash course was like the movie Field of Dreams, where you built it not knowing where it was going to go, right?
Right.
And you just felt this terrible need to lay out the case, and the drop of water in the infield that becomes 2 drops, becomes 4, becomes 8. And then eventually you filled the stadium with water. But, you know, 5 minutes before the stadium's filled with water, it's just a puddle. Mm-hmm. And that's the law of the exponential, right? That Berkeley professor, what's his name? You know his name. Albert something, who talks about the law of the exponential. Mm-hmm. So the blow off, right? The exponential that finally blows up, it happens so fast in the final stage that it's very unpredictable. Because right up until that point, you don't even see it. And then, bam, it's like an explosion. Right? Yep. Never saw it coming. You just end up with, you know, shards of stuff in your forehead.
Yeah. Yeah. You know, Mr. Bartlett, Al Bartlett, I gave a talk on the crash course in 2009. So I'd just finished it, and I'm out and I'm in Colorado, and I'm at the nice auditorium, about 300 people showed up, and he was one of them. He showed up. And so I gave a talk on exponentials to Al Bartlett. It was the most awkward moment of my stage career.
Holy Christ.
I really wasn't comfortable with it.
Find that talk of his, by the way, in case they haven't seen it, because his talks on the exponential are really good too.
Oh, fantastic. Just a well-oiled machine of a talk. It's so good. And just inescapable in its conclusions, you know. And so I feel like there's just a lot of shenanigans and dancing to try and figure out how to avoid what really is, like, look, we can't just continue to expand debt at 8% when the economy is growing at 4% or less, right? It just doesn't pencil out. And every all well-meaning people know that. And the only way you escape that over time is by dropping interest rates lower and lower and lower. And that works until you hit zero. And that's where we got to. And they danced around with negative rates. And that turned out to be even more soul crushing than zero. So they've backed off and we're kind of flittering around at zero or just north of zero. But there's nowhere else to go on that particular story. And so to me, you know, the obvious escape valve when you see that your authorities can't figure out how to get out of the debt cycle, so they're going to just risk something more catastrophic. So gold to me is a clear way historically that's been good to sort of sidestep shenanigans like that. But what can I say about gold here except that the GLD Tracking Trust has now dumped gold for 28 straight days post the Trump election. That's a record. And I can't account for this except that to use that word shenanigans or either that or these or these investors, whoever they may be, are idiots. Because listen, in those 28 days, we've had Trump calling Taiwan and then taunting China about a stolen drone. We've got Russian relations and communication channels, all-time lows. We've got Venezuela disintegrating. Central banks easing every 3 days we talked about. And I can't make sense of any of this except to say either I have this narrative completely wrong or somebody's doing something that just doesn't make any logical sense at all.
Yeah, well, as you know, but I'll just say it again. I've been a gold bug since 99 and I was buying it up until around 2000. God, you know, it gets so vague. You sort of remember this, but around 2004 or five, I think I was buying it up to around 600 an ounce. And then I said, I got enough. And then we got to 11 and it got its butt kicked, right? Mm-hmm. And to me, if you look at the long wavelength cycles, I'm not an Elliott waiver, but I believe that there might be times where it's not a crazy model. And so that really felt like just the first correction of something that was moving way up. And so for 4 years, you and I had to eat a lot of buckets of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
About, you know, you're just a gold bug and your days are done now and that game is over. And so I took the beatings for those 4 years. It not only was painful watching it go. Now, my cost basis was on average around $330 an ounce. So it wasn't that bad because it was dropping from 19 to 11 or something, right?
Mm-hmm.
1900 to 11. But when it finally seemed to run out of gas to the downside in 2015, I started buying again. In 15, I was pretty aggressive. In 16, right at the very beginning of the year, I dropped the equivalent of a half of my annual salary on gold again. And then throughout the year, and I actually hadn't done the math, I actually ended up buying more throughout the year than an entire annual salary of gold.
Mm-hmm.
So I clearly am voting with my dollars and feet, and my gold positions are pretty big. I'm still over 50% cash. And the people say, well, that's just stupid. It's like, no, it's not. The only way you're ever going to buy cheap assets at the bottom is to have cash. You got to get out of the market before it heads down or you're going to have nothing, right? My dad taught that. And so cash is king. Right now, the opportunity cost of sitting on cash is zero. There's no interest rate, so it doesn't matter. If you buy a bond, you make nothing. And if you buy equities, you're taking huge risks. And so, and people say, yeah, but you know, you're out too early, you're an idiot, you're a fool. And I'm going, you know, when you guys are, you know, in fetal position with the Dow sitting at 9,000 or something, you're going to be rethinking that model, I think.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about some people who maybe need to rethink that then. In the time we have remaining, you know, I've been on this wealth conference circuit, and it's been fantastic because I get to talk with people who are in particular, the people who aren't working with other people's money are highly concerned at this point in time. And I have one set of conversations, but people who have other people's money at play are come in a couple flavors. And in particular, I've been interacting with pension managers. So these are like, you know, the Austin firefighters pension, or, you know, people like identifiable
pensions,
you know. And so the pension managers, they come in two flavors, Dave, delusional and panicking. Right. The delusional ones think 7.5% returns are coming back. They have this explanation for why that has to be true, because they're hanging their hat on a different sort of mean reversion, which is we used to get returns like that. So they must be coming back. Right. The panicking ones know that they personally won't be dead before their funds blow up and angry retirees find them and have hard conversations with them. So it's just astonishing to me. But no, neither of those groups, I couldn't get either of those groups to say the central banks have destroyed our model, which is what I think is clearly what happened, right? But they can't go there.
Well, the other thing is we get told this model, the 7.5%, 7.5% return has never been correct. And the reason it's not correct is, first of all, they never inflation adjust it. And when they do, you find out that if you inflation adjust it and you throw in the dividends, you get the 4 to 5%. But the 4 to 5% does not include still our fees and taxes. And so now you're down to like 3%. And by the way, it's not a coincidence that that's kind of the growth of the GDP over the 20th century, right?
There it is.
And so... So any model based on the assumed 7.5% return is doomed, 7 to 8%. Now, here's the place that makes it really doomed. As you get low returns, you go, oh, my cow, we gotta save, you know, our pensions in trouble. As the returns shoot above the norm, they say, well, this is excess, and they scoop it up. And so they don't let the excess become more excess because, by the way, there's a mean reversion coming, and that's not going to be excess forever. So every time they're way above water, they scoop it up. And how they do it, they stop contributing. They use the money for other stuff. So if you have like a sine wave oscillating about the mean, even if you've guessed the mean correctly, if every time it's on the high side, you skim it, you'll never get the mean. And that's what pension managers have done. They and companies, they just stopped contributing to pension plans and started calling them profits, which makes equities go up, which makes the thing get out of whack. The other thing I talk about, and I think this is really important, is we got a recession coming. I think we've been in kind of this labored economy for a very long time. But at some point, we will have one of the full-blown kind, right? The kind that is just the kind that's so bad that the central bankers realize that we have a recession, right? And I don't know what's going to happen. My prediction is that's going to be a bad one. But what a lot of people don't realize is that's when things start unwinding. So the house of cards is built starts crumbling. And so counterparty risk kicks in and bad business models start showing up as bad and they start collapsing. And all the corporate chicanery, all the accounting problems, which are built up behind the scenes so that the people have cooked the books to get their bonuses up and they've made these crazy assumptions. Under the protective cloak of a recession, a CEO can get away with announcing anything. Because they say, hey, don't look at me, it's a recession. And so they write down huge blocks of costs. They write down all sorts. And so it actually exacerbates the downswing because people are dumping all their cooked books and getting all the chicanery off their books so that they don't have to fess up to the fact that they cooked them. And well, so they're getting ready to then start building up their stock options again from some bottom somewhere.
Well, this is why I think this next recession, when, not if, but when it comes, and to the point that even the central banks have to recognize it, why I think it's going to be so bad is corporate debt, right? So you've got this piece in there that the corporate debt, it isn't just up a little bit. It's up a lot, a huge amounts, you know, and still the shills in the mainstream media are just like, oh, look at all this corporate cash, you know? Yeah, that's great. But let's look at corporate debt. And many of these companies in whole sectors, in fact, in whole indexes, we find that debt is up higher than their cash flows, meaning from a net position, their cash flow negative. And it's just astonishing to look at this and say, well, eventually that has to be paid down, right? And in a recession, you probably have a rising interest rate environment. It's possible. But anyway, corporate debt, it's just off the charts. It's amazing. It's astonishing. And this era of financial engineering, whether it's the non-GAAP cooked books that you're talking about, or it's the pretending things are better than they are by borrowing money to buy back shares and pump up the stock price, it all feels a little fake to me. And maybe I'm just too cynical at this point in life, but it all just doesn't feel right.
Well, but you're not. This is not just a feel thing. You know that, right? You're saying you're much more convinced, and it has to do with historical measures, right? You can say, well, what does history have to do with anything? History has everything to do with everything, right? And so, and I don't need to understand a correlation if for example, this price of the stock market correlates with the price of walnuts. I don't care if there's causality. If that correlation is strong enough, I'll say, look, I'm going to start watching the price of walnuts, right?
Uh-huh.
And so the problem with the corporate debt is since 2009, it more than doubled. And I think that's where I actually define the 72 rule for the casual reader. And it's up like 9% a year. And their earnings aren't close to that. Their earnings are tiny compared to that. And so yeah, that's going to unwind. It has to unwind. This is like a person who weighs 850 pounds. They're not going to make it to their 90s, right? Mm-hmm. So.
Well, that's absolutely all true, and we could talk. Gosh, we barely scratched the surface here, so maybe we'll do this again soon. So everything we've been talking about, we found in part one of the year in review, and of course, there's a part two. Didn't even get to that most of the topics there, and I would love to get to those at some point, including especially the pieces around what's really going on with this election and what we might expect from a Trump presidency. Real estate. We didn't get into real estate. Which is, I've got a whole piece on that, which you made me think about very carefully as well. And really what's going on with these rigged primaries and what's happening, of course, in campus politics, which you are closer to than anybody else I ever talked to. So those would all be things I would love to talk about.
That's the campus politics section is the scariest section for me because it's just campuses are going nuts. So. Yeah, someday we'll have to talk about them.
Well, yeah, it's there's something about. I think I'm reminded of that scene in The Princess Bride, where this word it does not mean what you think it means. And that word is tolerance. I'm not real clear that people understand actually what that word means, like how it's used to intolerantly shut people down. So a whole conversation we could have there. So listen, Dave, thank you so much for your time today. Unfortunately, we have to cut this here. People listening, you can, of course, find the Year in Review at Peak Prosperity. So if you're listening to this on iTunes or you're finding this on YouTube or wherever you're finding this particular podcast, we'll have the Year in Review up there, and of course, it will be syndicated out. You might see it on Zero Hedge as well. So come on by and check it out and fully reference one of the best year-end reviews you're going to find, and you will laugh. And if I guess, fair warning, if you're easily triggered, this may not be the right Year in Review for you. Dave Barry's might be better. So with that, Dave, thank you so much for your time today.
My pleasure, always.